CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com with Love and Troy Sivan. That guy's gone on to do well. Little kid born in South Africa. He lives in America now, but he, for a while, his parents were in Australia. And he's the star of Spud, right? Gone on to be a musician as well, and a huge singing star.
I did not know that this was another South African product.
Goodness. Yeah, well, we claim him like we kind of claim Roger Federer through his mother, you know.
But we less...
tangentially.
We are less open to claiming Lana Marks.
Who's that?
Lana Marks is the new,
US
ambassador,
to
South Africa.
Why are we so reticent to claim her?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's because there's this whole mystique around the fact that she lives at Mar-a-Lago, which is where she met Donald Trump.
And that's why she got the job.
Well, except, you know, she's been living there for about 13 years, way before Trump actually considered running for president. So it clearly wasn't a career opportunity that she was after.
And she had continues to have a very successful handbag business, I think.
Yeah, among other things.
Yeah.
But LanaMarks.com, and it's, bespoke bags. You know, one would think that the Gucci set that we have out here would be happy to embrace it, because I believe they're actually at a significantly higher price point.
Very good.
Not that I'm in the market for handbags, of course.
Okay, well, there we go. We're going to be joined in a little while by Kantia Hunter, who is obviously a writer.
Is that how you pronounce that?
I think so. We'll find out from her just now. But I'd like to say it properly and not get it wrong.
Yeah, same here. So I just have, you know, kind of been reticent
say anything. We'll start off by asking her, and we'll make sure we get it right. You can sit anywhere you prefer. How are you? Is it Kantia? How do I say it properly without screwing it up?
You know, you can say it however you like.
No, so what's the correct way, please?
Kwanita.
Kwanita. All right.
Okay. But I'm very used to people pronouncing it wrong. I don't think my parents even have a proper way of saying it.
Kwanita, I'm sorry, because I've read a lot of your stuff over the years, and I've never really been sure whether I was pronouncing it right in my head. And now I actually have you in front of me. And
politician calls me Quinton, so.
All right, well, thank you for joining us on The Burning Platform. Kantia is still in her early 20s. A journalism career is an incredible one for someone so young. It's really been impressive. After covering some of the biggest political stories in South Africa in recent years, she's now put her analysis into a new book, which is called Balance of Power, and that is out now, Ramaphosa and the Future of South Africa. I actually got my copy this week, so I'm going to make my way through that. She's joining us this morning to look at some of the week's political happenings and give us a glimpse into her new book. It is out. It is available.
Yes, it is available. And
good. How's it doing?
It just started, so it's too soon to call. You are my first interview.
Well, I'm very happy that we can give your book a bit of a plug, because I'm sure it's fascinating. So what did you do from a research point of view with regard to this book, or is it more of a compilation of the experiences of the last year and a half, 2 years of Cyril Ramaphosa?
So I've been sort of following Ramaphosa from the time he had become deputy president in 2012, of the ANC, and then later of the country in 2014. But over the course of the last year or so, I literally dedicated my time, especially on the election campaign, to follow him around, to follow his interactions as he campaigned to become, the sixth president, or the president in the sixth administration. Also, this book is not so much a biography of Cyril Ramaphosa. There are biographies
of Cyril. Yeah, there are a couple of those.
Yes. So this here is more of a sort of through anecdotes and through my own observations, and then also through behind the scenes information, piecing together what made Cyril Ramaphosa president.
Uh-huh.
And so it's.
And I think probably also the since it's called Balance of Power, the fact that he's managing these factions in the ANC at the moment, and that there's all this quiet sort of noise going on underneath the water.
And also,
I say quiet on top, it's noisy underneath. Yeah.
But the thing is, Gareth, is that this type of maneuvering and this balancing of power started from the moment he was elected deputy president and I kind of weave of how he was, you know, politically convenient at that time. But also going into things like you know, the whole New Dawn Tumamina.
Right.
And funny enough, do you know the whole Tumamina, Huma Sikela kind of lyrics that he quoted in his first State of the Nation address that everyone applauded? That was actually written for Jacob Zuma to read. It was not his idea. And his advisors actually advised against it. And Tumamina became the slogan of his of his presidency.
Who knew?
Well, Kanita knew. Uh-huh. That's why she's here today. See, she knows a lot of stuff we don't know. All right, we're going to look at some of the stories in the news. But just so that that everybody's aware, and some of the things that you've covered over the last couple of years, in real depth, the rise and fall of Musi Maimane. And really, has anyone disappeared more effectively than he has in the last couple of days?
Well, if recent rumors are true, he's apparently starting a new political party.
And planning a comeback of sort.
Do you have any...
It's fine.
No, I mean, is there any way in hell that he can get this right? Does anyone care?
Well, we could talk about Musi at some point, but you know, I still want to hear more about Kanita's whole take on the Ramaphosa.
Well, she's been covering President Ramaphosa and also his work on gender-based violence.
Because one of the things that
it.
I want to know, based on the stuff that's going on this morning, is this the moment of truth where he's got to face off with the unions around SAA? Because, you know, they're on strike this morning.
Yeah, that's right.
And NUMSA is promising it's going to be the biggest strike ever. And the question really is, if he's determined to go through this whole process of pulling the country back on track, pulling SAA to order is clearly a critical part of that. And the question is now, if he backs down, where does that leave us?
You see, it's a thing that of trying to be, you know, a pleaser to everyone, which I think doesn't really bode well for him. It's, we need to do things by consensus. We need to unite people. So we even need to forge unity with thieves, because unity and consensus. So it's almost this kind of fake Mandela-esque kind of persona.
It's like he's pretending to be a politician.
You know, but it's you see, when it's moments of reckoning like this, it's when you know, people are desperate to kind of get some sort of, you know, strong leadership to say, okay, this is what government stand is. This is the line in the soil, and we're not going to step it. But I, from my interactions, from my following of the president, it's always consultations about consultations. We'll try to find something amicable, and hopefully people will get tired and forget about it.
Yeah, except he can't really consult his way out of this one.
Because, I mean, ANC, what they've done to NUMSA is not really fun and games. And then the other issue is SA has no money, so you can't promise.
The realities are just going to hit them hard between the eyes. So either NUMSA are going to find themselves proving that the unions have lost their teeth, or the president's going to be shown to have lost his teeth.
I'm off the view, by the way, that the issue here really is that the pilots are not on strike, but the cabin crew are on strike.
That's right.
Now, frankly, I don't believe that SAA really needs cabin crew, because they are the most surly, uncooperative bunch that I come across on any airline. I just want to put that out there. And more to the point, it's generally impossible to walk down the corridors and get past them, because, you know, they do tend to have girth of a 747. So, yes.
I will not comment on that.
Kanita's looking at me right now.
She's about to smack you with some toxic masculinity comment.
No, yes. It's fat shaming. I'm happy to accept toxic masculinity, but not in this context. It's got nothing
to do. In this context, you only have limited space in the corridor.
Yes.
What I get more annoyed by is the other passengers who knock you as they walk past you, but we'll leave that for another day.
So, Ramaphosa?
This is the point. Okay, so we do have one of the largest proportional imbalances between employed people in our airline and actual passengers in the world.
Correct.
So there's some kind of correction has to be made there.
Well, actual passengers and actual aircraft as well, yes.
Yes, aircraft too. So I think it's something like proportionally... Emirates, which are much bigger airline, successful, they make money. They're also state-owned in some respect, because, you know, everything in the UAE is owned essentially by the state, who's also one person. So it's a kind of absolute monarchy. But the fact is they operate, and they've got I think it's 50 more planes, 50 times the number of planes we have, and they have something like a third of the cabin crew that we have.
Wow.
So there's a lot of sheltered employment going on in SAA.
Yes, but also a lot of drug smuggling, so they are side rackets. That, I mean, no, come on, guys.
We gotta, they have caught them, you're right.
Yes, but we have to factor this in. Just remember that the drug smuggling is their main gig. The other thing in terms of SAA crew is the stealing of luggage is also part of the thing as well. And all of the stuff are under NUMSA's watch.
That's true. So how do you feel it's going to be resolved?
Well, I sincerely hope that as a net result of this, that, you know, NUMSA effectively ends up getting wiped out. I think it's time to stare them down, not let those planes fly until such time as NUMSA eventually, you know, cries uncle. And at that point, the planes can start flying again. Because, look, it's going to be cheaper for us as taxpayers right now for those planes to not fly.
Hmm.
And I think, you know, the Public Enterprises Minister really needs to get to the bottom of what's going to happen with SAA, because every time there's a talk about privatization, there's like, you know, some sort of tantrum that's thrown by the unions and by the left of the ANC. And then you know, government just injects a few billion in it, and then you carry on to the next year where it's going under again, and this tantrum continues. And the reality of it is that SAA is not like Eskom. It's not a core asset. It's bleeding taxpayers' money. We have to get to a point to say this is a vanity project, and we have to either dispose of it or get you know, private partnership in it. And the reality of it, it's going to be so bad that even private entities.
Why would they want?
Why would they want to buy it?
They wouldn't want to invest. I mean, if I gave you SAA shares now, you wouldn't want them because you'll end up in debt
immediately. Yes, because I've got to manage the cash flow. I think you know, the immediate call on the fuel bill is something like $500 million.
Yeah, I don't see how this is going to be resolved.
They tend to buy fuel on credit.
All right, so SAA is bringing us to some kind of critical point now.
Yeah, I think so. And look, I'm really hoping that our president grows a spine in this particular case, you know, as opposed to bending with the wind as he's tended to do, exactly as Juanita has been describing.
You know, Juanita, you cover in your book the cabinet changes that Ramaphosa brought about, Malusi Gigaba's exit, which we've forgotten now. It's almost like ancient history, but it was a year ago, maybe even less.
Yeah.
And people seem to have a very short memory for this stuff. How well is his new cabinet doing? And since we had such a problem with all the Zuma appointees, have his people fared any better?
Yeah, you see, the funny thing is that over 50, maybe even 70% of his cabinet is Zuma appointees. So it's not...
And he sees the same bunch of people, right?
Absolutely. And so the thing is that Ramaphosa campaigned on that he's going to drastically reduce the size of the executive. And he didn't do that. In fact, there's more deputy ministers under him. And you know, deputy ministers are glorified PAs, right? So they're ribbon cutters, really. So what he did was he spoke a big game. And you see it in many things as well. And something that's not in my book, but you know, is quite topical, is that he promised at the time that the cabinet ministers are going to have these KPIs. They're going to sign performance agreements. And that was 5 months ago. There's no agreements, meaning some deputy ministers, and by some I mean all, go to work not knowing what they're going to do and waiting for the minister to say, I can't cut a ribbon in Musina Limpopo. Can you please go? And off he or she goes with two bodyguards and two state cars and state resources to cut a ribbon in a random place.
It sounds like you're joking, but you're actually serious. This is a lot of what deputy ministers do. They're not involved in policy making necessarily.
They're not members of cabinet.
They're not in cabinet. They're not directors general, so they don't actually execute. So what's the point of these people? They really are just glorified ANC cadre deployments in a position where you have a title and supposedly some kind of government benefit, but no use to the country.
Absolutely not. And you can't even step in for the minister if the minister's away. Do you know that?
So
Another minister has to step in. So really, why do we have a deputy? And you see, the funny thing is that Ramaphosa went in saying, we don't need deputy ministers, and then gets caught by the process. So I think what's a bigger thing, Gareth, is that is the chalice too poisoned, you know, and was Ramaphosa given a house on fire, you know, that kind of metaphor, and can he then put out the fire and then rebuild the building, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, you're the right person to answer this because you've been observing him for a long time. How's he coping with this factionalism? Because we haven't had an update for a while. Ace Magashule has been very quiet.
Yes,
absolutely. And so is David Mabuza. Very quiet, these two.
And the reason why they're quiet is because the ANC only exists around the time of internal party elections. So at this year, there was no contestation on any level. Next year is the party's midterm kind of review, and that's when we're going to see everyone rising again. There's no party activity happening. Really, you could even say the party's a bit dead this year.
Wow.
Because elections are over. Elections have been won. Mostly, and people got their positions, people got their jobs, and now when their jobs are on the line again, so does the fighting start.
While we've got you here, what is your take on the current state of journalism in the country? And we see lots of independent media being less independent than we'd like. We see this ugly story of Iqbal Serv constantly rearing its ugly head. And it's really hard for people to understand whether or not there are purveyors of fake news in South Africa and who those people are, who the people are that can be trusted, how much should we rely on the internet. You know, there are obviously people like you we can follow on social media and then we can get the direct stuff. But how do people like, you know, the journalists who may be doing that kind of thing in a very honest and credible way, how do they get their money and who's paying for this? And should we be suspicious of the people who are?
Yeah, so there's a few things, Gareth. So the first of which is that journalism is in a very precarious state in South Africa at the moment. A, because of financial interests, because of people like Iqbal Survey, whose egos dominate why they run media houses. Mm. The other issue is there is no money. Yeah. So, you know, you're doing so much more for so much less. Also, the juniorization of the newsroom. I'm a junior in the newsroom.
Do you find that offensive when people talk
about
the juniorization?
No, I don't. Because, and I used to, but when you speak to people who have 40 years of experience and you realize they actually bring so much of value, they may not be able to assimilate and blah, 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 but they have the value that is being lost because nobody can afford them anymore.
Right.
And the more important thing is that because of clicks, we're losing journalism just because of clicks. And so everyone is chasing...
Yeah, is it ideological clicks? Is it...
No. We're talking about clicks as
clickbait,
an online clicks.
Clickbait.
Oh,
yeah. That's
because
I was thinking, when you now interrupted to say that, I thought, oh God, he's going to tell me it's clicks the company. Okay, you mean like clickbait.
Yes,
okay.
Because people are so desperate for some sort of revenue. There is no solution to digital. There is no solution to digital revenue. Google and Facebook is taking all the revenue.
It's clean up.
It's unsustainable. And so what happens now is Gareth Cliffe's new hairstyle is going to do better than my 3-week-long investigation about a mining company.
Is that a new hairstyle?
No, same one. That's why it's not a news story. But your point is well taken.
And the reality of it is that it's just becoming more and more tempting to do the stories that are low-hanging fruit instead of spending the time and the resources in digging. I still believe that when South Africa was facing the ugly belly of state capture and democracy and state institutions were a threat, it was the media that held South Africa up. And I think we will do ourselves the biggest disservice is if we take our eye off the ball.
I agree with you completely. I mean, if we hadn't found out about Waterkloof Air Force Base and the wedding that the Guptas landed all their guests at Waterkloof for, we would never have known about 90% of what transpired afterwards in the state capture and obviously what we've learned subsequently in the State Capture Commission, which we'll talk to you about in a second. You want to add something to that, Councillor?
Well, I was going to say one of the issues that we got in this country is that a lot of journalists actually don't understand economics, because if that was the case, then we'd actually be able to build profitable media businesses. And, you know, as an example, I'll point out that there are places in the world where old-fashioned newspapers actually continue to grow. So good examples of that are places like...
the New York Times.
Well, let's just park the New York Times for a second, because that's an interesting different case. But if we take a view around newspapers in Hong Kong as an example, newspapers in India, and right here in our own backyard, the only newspapers that have actually shown increases in circulation over a period, small but measurable increases, have been the Zulu papers in KZN.
Like Isolezwe
and Ilanga, which, you know, have continued to hold their own. And so essentially what it shows is that if you can come up with an appropriate business model that actually works, people will be willing to pay for it. And I think we're seeing lots of paywalled websites now coming up and people actually subscribing to it. I think the Daily Mavericks business model of you basically pay them a subscription to become a Maverick insider, which still keeps the content free, by the way, but mm-hmm. they're actually encouraging people to fund their operations on an ongoing basis.
Like The Guardian in the UK, it's the same model.
Yeah, except The Guardian in the UK is such a pawn of the military-industrial complex in the UK that I don't want to use that as a business model. So, but yes, essentially what we need to do is to look for ways, and Kwanita is looking at me askew now. Just show me the Guardian's coverage of what goes on in terms of the UK military atrocities in Yemen, and I will then tell you, yes, the Guardian is a credible source.
I'm not saying it's credible or not. I'm saying that's the business model.
There's certainly funding that comes behind the scenes in that particular case. The New York Times, essentially one of the reasons why the New York Times is successful is because they are actually a massive number of affiliates all around the country.
So they buy up their content.
The affiliates are basically, you know, small town newspapers that are inherently profitable in their own right, and then they're able to aggregate the content from those places just because of the sheer volume. And again, it's a good business model.
Well, for both of you, I'd like to get into this situation that became a little bit of a storm in a teacup on Monday and Tuesday of this week, where the former president Jacob Zuma's tax returns were the topic of everyone's interest. Now, SARS say they will not release this because it's not their business to release individual taxpayers' information, which I think is something that most people would appreciate. You know, if SARS was just prepared to let anyone and everyone's tax returns go out there, it could end up being very, you know, very uncomfortable for some people, and probably not necessarily because they're bad people.
My question around that is, what is the problem that our public protector is trying to solve? Because if the public protector is really trying to work out a paper trail around illicit payments that were made to the former president, and I think the payments from Roy Moodley were kind of at the top of that list in terms of that security company that he had.
Yeah, well, he was a security guard who earned millions of rands a month.
Exactly, but essentially during that time, our former president was on his payroll. And essentially what you need to do in that case is not to subpoena the tax returns, but to subpoena the bank accounts, and to see the way in which the flow of money actually worked there. So you need to...
Can you do that?
That's not hard to do. So in fact, that's the route that the public protector needs to be going.
But it also seems the same public protector found ample evidence for who had bankrolled Cyril Ramaphosa's campaign leading up to Nasrec.
My point exactly.
With no problems whatsoever.
Because that's the route that one needs to go. The tax returns are not going to show anything other than whether the president actually ended up paying tax on particular transactions.
And he might have lied in his tax returns.
Or more to the point, his taxes might actually have been paid, but the more crucial thing is who paid the taxes. Where did the money come from? Hence my saying that the paper trail needs to be on the bank accounts. So my view is that we'll have a scenario where the public protector ends up potentially getting access to the tax returns, is then able to publish a report that says President Jacob Zuma has faithfully paid his taxes, and that then adds to the anti-Cyril narrative. And I'm not buying it for a second.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you were to do a credible investigation, tax returns, you're not going to start. I mean, it's really not going to really reveal anything so much. But what also I find fascinating with regards to the public protector is one of her allies who used to work in her office, who just got fired recently, the chief operating officer, Basani Baloyi, has now taken her to court and has literally lifted the lid on all the suspicions that have been going out publicly, and people who have been implicated in reports making accusations against her. Now, this insider saying, yes, she used she played politics. Here's WhatsApp messages of how she played politics.
Oh, wow.
She says, we have to play chess, in reference to Pravin Gordhan's case. She basically subverted some sort of evidence to protect her CEO, who was actually implicated in one of her reports in his previous job. So an insider now confirming and saying, when she was investigating Busasa, she actually brought in outsiders who are unknown to the public protector's office to actually do the investigations, meaning employees of the PP's office did not do the investigation. So I really think we're kind of going to see how that pans out. But I think that if Basani Baloyi wins this court case, it's going to be, at least one of the final nails in Mkhwebane's coffin.
Well, we've been carrying this coffin around for a long time.
3 years.
She keeps jumping out of it like those guys at those fake churches do whenever they are raised from the dead. So I don't know if she's going anywhere anytime soon, but certainly her credibility at this point is paper thin.
Absolutely. And I think that, there's so much of smoke now, and it's different. It's different. People involved. It may not only be, the president and his allies that are taking her reports and review. It's people like Robert McBride. It's people like Google and Quinty, who's now also fired. So the reality of it is that there's also a real issue of inefficiency.
Right.
And now there's a process to appoint her deputy in parliament. And I think that's also going to be important, because with the outgoing deputy, there was an effort to just sideline him and say, you are Zimbabwean, you have security concerns, you can't touch our reports, literally. And and now there's an effort to replace, his term has come to an end, and now Parliament is considering the appropriate candidate to replace him. And I really hope that for the sake of that office, you get a good, credible lawyer who understands the law and is efficient and can stand up to her.
Hmm. You think that's going to happen?
Yes, I think it's going to happen. But the ability to actually enforce your will when you're second in command is actually quite difficult to do. So, but I think
How long does she still have in office?
Four
more years of Mkhwebane.
Well, the problem is that if you look in terms of the way in which our constitution is structured, there isn't a process that has actually been put in place for the removal of heads of these institutions.
Yeah, so there's no way that the president can act unilaterally.
The starting point needs to be that we draft legislation that actually provides circumstances under which you can remove the public protector, which then obviously needs to pass constitutional scrutiny. So that means that ultimately there will be challenges from the likes of the EFF, even if it... But here's the thing. It can actually... if they draft the legislation appropriately, the ANC and the DA together have a two-thirds majority and will be able to pass that through, effectively bypassing the constitution. And I think this is one of those cases, the rare cases, where the ANC and the DA would probably
agree
right now. Unless you take the view that, Ramaphosa is reluctant to do so because there is a significant chunk of his own factions that would not allow him to do that.
The other thing is that you want to also guard from the phenomenon of when you are implicated by the public protector, you then seek to impeach him or her.
Right.
That is
then
really
it looks
bad.
Like you're guilty and you're coming down like a hammer.
So I think what's more important is to get the courts to say, and I mean so many courts have already pronounced on her fitness to hold office. The Constitutional Court was extremely damning against her, and actually, ruling that she, like, she was so that she needs to be personally liable for cost order. And so I think that the best way to actually deal with the issue is to get definitive judgments to say this case she erred in this manner, she violated the constitution. Mm-hmm. The interesting bit is that in many of these cases is the orders that the applicants want. So in Basani Bilwe is one example, the president, etc. They want the court to decide that she violated her constitutional oath of being unbiased and fair and balanced. And so as a result, if multiple courts then rule that she had violated the constitutional oath and she's unfit to hold office, then Parliament can take up the matter and try to put in some process to impeach her. The problem is we only look at the law when it comes to certain people. So
it looks like we're applying it discriminatingly,
rather than indiscriminately. And there's a flip side to it, because when the constitution was written, it was kind of also written for Mandela. So the powers that are also given to the president, which is a completely different subject, is really, if you look at the problems in the NPA, it's because the president has too much of power in that instance. So it's kind of now moving back or taking a step back 25 years or 26 years later to say, okay, how can we now get to a point where we are amending the constitution in a way that is going to fit all circumstances and is the perfect balance for the years to come.
Speaking of balance, have your relations with the ANC Women's League improved? there was a story, I'm sure a lot of people don't know this, but just in case you don't know, last year you got an image of a gun from the ANC Women's League Secretary General and a text message while you were reporting that former President Jacob Zuma and his allies were plotting to unseat Cyril Ramaphosa. They basically threatened you. What happened with that?
South Africa.
You must have taken it seriously. If someone sent me an image of a gun, I'd, especially if this.
Yeah, at the time, it was quite serious. I think the rule that we have as journalists is that you don't want to become the story, and I think the story was so compelling at the time. The actual story I was investigating about that Maharani meeting was because everyone who was in the meeting and was seen in the meeting, and we confronted them as they left the meeting, said there was no meeting. So obviously that kind of unearthed an effort to rebel against the Ramaphosa presidency. And so there was this kind of tension. Only after a very terrible statement was issued, very personally charged statement against me, and this was not my first run-in with the Women's League. There's been very many times I've had run-ins with them, but also the type of defamatory kind of statement that they issued, and then I thought it was important to make it public that that the Women's League Secretary General had sent me this threatening message. She said yes, the message was sent from her phone, but she didn't necessarily send it. It's funny.
One of her kids sent it by mistake.
Yeah, but funny, she sent it 2 minutes after I had spoken to her on the phone, and she denied being at the meeting despite photography evidence. So that was quite interesting. The other thing that I've really, really been trying to highlight together is the issue of mental health in journalism.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that's not taken seriously. I didn't realize how much those threats and all of... And I mean, that was just one incident. There's been many incidents, and especially the kind of gendered threats, the kind of online harassment and bullying that we constantly face as political reporters, or as reporters, that the consequence it had on my mental health. And when I started speaking about it and saying, I've started seeking help, I've had, anxiety as a result, I've started seeing a professional. So many people had come forward and said, this online harassment seems so silly because you're supposed to just ignore it and, just dust it off and continue. But the reality of it is it has a profound impact on your mental health and your ability to just continue as a journalist.
Well, I mean, you don't want to carry on digging into really complex and dirty stories if you are fearful for your own life and if people are threatening you.
Look, the truth of the matter is that journalism has always been one of those professions
where, and I mean, if
you look around the world to this day in terms of the number of journalists that actually get killed in the course of their investigations, I mean, we've got Putin's record in terms of this. We've seen what the Saudis have done. And it actually comes with the territory. You know, I'm one of those.
But I'm
one of those who says that. Look, basically, if we get into this business, we actually need to recognize this actually comes with the territory. Is there a problem with not enough of an outcry on the point of view of civil society as a whole in terms of protecting journalists? Yes, I certainly think that that's the case. But at the same time, I think that there's a lot more that civil society could be doing to speak up on a lot of things that actually
you disagree?
And I'm not saying this to in any way, you know, pour any scorn upon the very real, the stuff you're feeling is real.
But I understand the territory thing, but I don't understand the normalization of it because
it's always been that way.
No, and that's true, but now it's the harassment coming into your bedroom through your phone.
Because suddenly it's online.
It's the accessibility that comes from increases
and the volume.
In technology, yes.
I think what you're saying is very
because
potent.
Now you're able to crowdsource that particular type of
harassment. There have been journalists who've done themselves no favors in all of this too. I mean, there was that story which I only found out about here on the Burning Platform once about that Roxanne Joseph woman who faked her own cancer. Do you remember that story?
Yeah.
Yes.
And basically she brought the whole idea of mental health to the fore in some respect there because she clearly has a problem. And she clearly has, you know, a condition that she needs treatment for, that she needs to sit down and talk to someone about at very least, if not a whole lot more. And there are people in every profession who have to deal with this. But as you say, if you're looking at stories, and there are lots of reporters and journalists who go out and have to deal with
Gareth,
death,
destruction, devastation. I'm hesitant to go down that pathway because it's too similar to me to the, you know, women are asking for rape kind of argument. You know, the whole idea that because you have a couple of bad apples, that means that you immediately tar an entire profession with a particular narrative. But my point is, it's never going to go away in terms of journalism. We are never going to be able to get rid of that underlying threat. I'm one of the...
Juanita, why don't you stop hanging around meetings that you shouldn't be hanging around?
I'm part of the 40-year brigade, as an example, you know, and having gone through that entire period during the 80s when... You know, while security police were knocking on my front door, I was hopping over the back wall and escaping and heading down the road to William Saunderson Mayer's place, where I then lived for the
next
period.
Very unsympathetic, Canton.
No, but you see, I think you guys who covered the state of emergency are the problem, because it's almost as if, you know, in 1994 we were being shot at, and the reality of it is that this is a democracy. We should not have this level of harassment for journalists, and the reality of it is censorship. This type of harassment leads to censorship, which is a media freedom problem. So if we don't deal with supporting journalists, if we don't deal with preserving mental health by creating an awareness to say, go for therapy, if you need a debrief, create these systems.
But you
as bosses of media houses come in and say, we cover this in the state of emergency. Look at you little kids. You got a few stones thrown at you at Marikana and now your life is over.
No, actually, you're absolutely right. I speak about that all the time. I call it millennial tears. And I'm completely unsympathetic.
But your whole generation is alcoholics. Like, your entire generation is alcoholics.
And proudly so. You know, I look forward to my GNT whenever I get home. But the fundamental issue that we need to recognize, and again, you know, it's the entire premise of, and I use this example all the time, okay, the reason why it is stupid to walk through the Noord taxi rank wearing a miniskirt is not because we should be entitled to wear whatever we want to, but because of the fact we don't have basic enforcement of laws that protect citizens. And the same is true in the case of journalists. We are out there in dangerous territory. We live in a country where a third of all of the police forces are actually put to the service of protecting the elite that run this country. There is no recourse to the law. And we are operating in a situation where we have no protection. And to suggest that journalists in particular be singled out for protection, whereas we should actually be turning around and saying we need to fix basic law enforcement in this country to the point that everyone is able to conduct their jobs without essentially the state security apparatus being turned upon
what we do on an ongoing basis.
I don't
think Anita is asking for
bodyguards.
Bodyguards. I think what she's saying
I'm saying we're not bodyguards, but rule of law.
And you know, I'm not some softy who's going to take the part of what you call millennial tears, but I think her point about how mental health, I think mental health is a big problem in South Africa, full stop.
Yes, it's absolutely real. But I'm saying the
average South African lives with so much violence and so much unhappiness and so much deep-seated misery and serious structural problems in their own lives that I think we have a crisis of a kind there. And that journalists are just as susceptible as anyone else in any other profession to this kind of mental health issue.
And worse so because you're in the belly of the beast.
Of the beast.
Yeah, but you know, the point that I've made here previously is that our entire narrative today as a species is my pain is greater than yours. And I'm saying we fix the rules. And that's the only way we eventually fix this.
Fine. Okay, well, that's not...
I think you're contradicting yourself because you're saying, just millennial tears, shrug it off, it's the nature of the game. Put the support in place because harassment is a censorship issue and it's a media freedom issue. That's the point I'm making.
Absolutely right. Harassment is a censorship issue. I agree with that completely. And the way in which I think that we shoot that down is at the point at which we get harassment, we turn our forces as journalists upon the people who are doing the harassing. Mm. And, we need to go after them as a pack. And we should be doing this. The trouble, of course, is that when we choose to go after particular people because, we think that they are the bad guys, but then, we choose not to investigate others because, we think that they're potentially on our side, is when things kind of fall apart. We need to be equal opportunity offenders. We need to be absolutely merciless in going after all of the parties involved right now.
The DA has gone quiet after all of their changes. Does anyone have any comment on them at all?
Well, now we can pick up again on the Moosey thing, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Because
I won't have any millennial tears.
Oh, God.
Juanita's crying. She's broken down.
You know, whenever I use the phrase millennial tears and goodness, the looks that I get, I'm sure.
And then you have to have a drink.
You alcoholic.
No, I do that in any case. Yeah, let's just talk Moosey for a second. Here's my take on it, and then you can tell me what you actually think about this. I think if Moosey starts a new party, it's actually a good thing. And the reason why I think it's a good thing is that I don't believe that Moosey is going to take DA voters with him.
Mm.
I do believe, though, that
there is
a space for another, a center-left political party. Because I think if you look in terms of the swing right now around the DA, I think it's now pulling back to being more of a centrist party, whereas under Moosey, it was moving center-left. Currently, the scenario that you've got is that if you don't want to vote for the DA, effectively your choices are either the ANC or the EFF. Now, if you have a reasonable middle-class voter who generally has center-left sort of social democrat-type leanings, you really don't have much of a choice. You either go to the ANC or you go to the DA. And is there space for a small party in between the DA and the ANC to start playing a role? I think the answer is yes. And I think what's likely to happen is that the place where Moosey is going to take votes away from is going to be the ANC.
Hmm.
I really think that, Moosey forming a party is just an employment scheme for him to guarantee a job in the next elections, because he's doing what so many people who've left parties, who've left the bigger political parties, whether it was the ANC,
Bantu Holomisa, Mosiwa Lekota,
Patricia Delo, and now you even in the provinces you even have splinters of the EFF, right?
Mm.
But
the EFF is exactly the same model.
Absolutely. But but what I'm saying to you is that, and without being spicy, is that there's something like 50 to 100 political parties contesting, and 11 make it out at the top. So what happens is that there's no real attempt to reform the opposition in South Africa in a way to say, let's get everyone together. It's people looking out for a job, because Musi has enough support to get one seat for him in the next election.
No, I take the view that Musi will probably pull a bit more, but also, you see, the whole idea of reforming the opposition, the crucial thing for me is not so much a reform of the opposition as much as us getting to the point where the ANC drops below 50%. Because when the ANC drops below 50%, then the smaller parties are in a position to actually influence real change in the way in which we govern ourselves. And right now, the chances of the ANC dropping below 50% based on either the EFF taking more votes from them, I don't think that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Or and the DA, you know, Gareth, we've talked about that on the show before, that even if the DA had maintained its, you know, steady 8% per annum increase in terms of its voting base, it would take it to around about 2030 or so before it was even pushing anywhere near the 50% mark. So in the interim, I think that there's actually space for, certainly in Musi's case, I think that if he's able to, if he's able to pull on board this broad, and you know, everyone tries to narrow this down into racial lines, but in fact, that, you know, there's an ideological schism within the DA based on people who, like Phumzile Van Damme, who theoretically should actually have been within the ANC and not within the DA. But I think he's very likely to take that sort of person into this new party with him. And I do believe that there are a number of voters who might actually look at voting for Musi just on the basis that they don't want to vote for Helen Ziller.
Yeah, that's quite possible. I also think that probably, look, you make a good argument that there might be a few people who are ideologically stranded somewhere between the ANC and the DA. They don't like either enough to vote for them, but they might vote for this. Maybe those are the people who Musi appealed to in the first place, and he tried to accommodate them into the DA instead of perhaps where they would be more comfortable somewhere in the hinterland.
My only point is that the formation of these smaller parties have the success rate and the is you know, there's not good examples besides perhaps maybe the EFF, which showed good growth, but so I would hope that Musi would look at the situation and not over-capitalize on his popularity, and also realize that the party, the DA, shrunk under him as well. So kind of understanding where he needs to fit in, but also realizing the state of politics where there's just a bunch of undecided voters that generally just flirt around with other smaller parties. My concern about smaller political parties is what happens in municipalities, where they almost, like, if you look at PE, Nelson Mandela Bay, where smaller political parties are not enhancing democracy there. In fact, there's just this constant level of chaos because smaller political parties, because there's no outright majority, number one, and number two, smaller political parties with one seat are overreaching their hand. I am not one of those political reporters that believe coalitions solve problems. I don't. I believe the African continent has enough examples of how coalition politics do not work efficiently for good governance or for governance. And so if people are expecting Musi to fill some sort of gap in a future coalition type of government, I think it's a little bit risky, considering what has happened in Tswane, in Johannesburg, okay, not Johannesburg, but Nelson Mandela Bay.
Okay.
I think that the pattern that we're actually seeing, and if you take a look at the spate of by-elections that we've been having recently, take the specific example of all of those councillors who were expelled from the ANC, who then went and stood as independents, and then basically won those seats. And I think to a large extent, what we should be seeing in terms of municipalities is more and more of that happening. I'd like to see a scenario where each ward basically is deciding what its own priorities are in terms of what they want to be achieving in terms of municipal governance. And that ward actually then electing a candidate for that area, as opposed to the scenario we've had up until now with both the ANC and the DA, where essentially the party puts forward the candidate and says, you know, here's the person that we are putting forward. So to a large extent, I think what we are starting to see in the municipalities is, in fact, the wave of the future. The directly elected councillors are, I think, actually going to determine the way in which municipalities should be run. And I think that that's actually a good thing. National government level is, I don't think it's going to end up being a coalition scenario. I think that the ANC is still effectively going to be the government. But in order to make specific decisions, they will actually need the support of one of the other parties, which is a kind of different scenario. So, you know, the ANC will not be able to elect a president, for example, without the support of either the DA or the EFF. So, you know, depending on the candidate that they put forward, they would need to find one that's acceptable. But none of the other parties will be in a position to form a government. And if you take that as a way of running the country on an ongoing basis, I think it actually makes the country more powerful. Because right now, Luthuli House makes the decisions. And we, as an electorate, are powerless to do anything about that.
Yeah, Khalima Mutlante actually is of that same view, where he is punting this thing of collaborative decision making, where and I mean, you're kind of seeing it a little bit in the Ramaphosa administration, you know, with getting maybe Patricia de Lille in a very key portfolio, also the efforts to extend an olive branch to Bantu Holomisa, the kind of courtesy, good relationship with the EFF. You know, despite the, you know, ongoing drama in Parliament. But I do think that you're right in the sense of a more collaborative type of government. The problem I see, though, and I hate to be that pessimist, is that we are so divisive by nature on any topic. So it's you either on the extreme end of the land question or the extreme right or the extreme left of the land question. So it then becomes very difficult to kind of find these logical middle grounds. Even if you just look on, like, even if you leave land and you just talk about, like, reforming healthcare, and no one can really agree on a good model when it comes to the NHI. So it may also just be a pipe dream.
Thank you for leaving us on such a depressing note.
I hate to be this person.
Yeah, I know. I was starting to think that we might get an optimistic ending to this platform this week.
Why don't you do your Trump accent for us before we go?
For what? What are we talking about this week?
Because the impeachment process has started formally. Yeah.
Please, it's a hoax. It's fake news, right? That's what he says.
Yeah, but you have to say it with a Trump accent. Yeah.
This is all fake news. It's a hoax. Don't believe it. Look at my little hands. Pay no attention to what's going on in Congress. Nancy Pelosi, she's a terrible woman.
I think it's a great note to end it on.
All right, well, thank you very much, both of you. Canton, thank you very much. Cornita's book launch is happening on Monday, November the 25th at 2019. That's this year. It's at 6 in the evening. You can go to Exclusive Books in Rosebank Mall, but you have to ask them if you can come. And you're not allowed to go if you're going to send her pictures of guns.
And on that note, by the way, I just also want to send a punt to Alida Dasna and Chris Whitfield, because they've put out their book on independent newspapers, Paper Tiger, which was launched last night.
All right. Thank you for that. There we go. Plenty for you to chew on this week on the Burning Platform. And if you do want to go to Cornita's book launch, then go to events@exclusivebooks.co.za and email them, and they will try and make a space available to you. Good luck with the book. Thank you for coming to spend time with us this morning. This is lots of fun. And we will see you tomorrow at 6 o'clock, bright and early, cliffcentral.com.
I'll be drunk.
Yeah, of course. Catherine's going to go and have a drink right now, and Cornita's going to cry. So between us, we'll all be fine. All right, that's how it works. Cliffcentral.com.